I'll just translate for myself briefly in this intro. Sivulipak Nunavumu Kovesapung Tisahrama Nuktume Ovanga Nuktitsungu Yunga Kitian Miki Yung Chris Yunga Penutumiatao Yunga Man Ekana Punga Hamlet Cook Institute Cook Making Connections for Youth Bigiakto November me 2007 Mana Ukahuma Yunga Kadunati. I'm just going to switch to English now, but I just said that because we're in Nunavut, I like to hear Inuktitut, and I noticed we haven't heard much today. So just a little introduction to myself that way. My name is Chris Hyde. I work and live in Penutu. I work for the Hamlet there, working with youth in a project called Making Connections for Youth, which started in November of 2007. And I'm going to go into a bunch of those things like NCPI, CSPD, things that don't translate too well. So I'm going to switch quickly to English, but I can come back if we need it. The Framework for Action for Northern Youth was something evolved mainly through the RCMP in about 2005, I think. And the idea was to reach out to Northern youth as a crime prevention through social development program, they call it. A number of organizations came together to get behind something called the Northern Communities Partnership Initiative, NCPI. They put the call out to Nunavut communities, and seven communities applied to host this initiative, and Penutu was the one chosen. It's a three-year pilot program for innovative programming for youth. So I should say, to sum it all up in 3 minutes is difficult. I do quite a bit as a coordinator of the program. I wouldn't be able to do any of it if it weren't for the Hamlet Youth Council that I work with. They are a really dynamic group of young people, chosen every year in an annual general meeting. There's 10 members of the Youth Council, and they administer a number of programs with me. I fundraise quite a bit for them, but they do a lot of the hands-on administration. For instance, they run the youth center in town, which is unusual because in many communities, youth centers are run by the recreation director and the recreation committee, which are usually adults, whereas our youth council are members from 13 to 30 years old, and they're very hands-on in the running of the youth center and the programs that happen there, which are multitudinous, actually. In addition to being a drop-in center and having a pool table and video games and that kind of thing, we also host the CAP site in town, so we have computer access there. We do a lot of the traditional skills programs, cabinet making, monkey making, parker making. We host land trips for hunting and fishing skills, and quite a few other programs that are run pretty much by the youth themselves with my help with raising funds. I also work with a number of other agencies in town, and a number of other federal and territorial government departments. There are actually 11 federal government departments that are supporting this project, 4 territorial and the 2 Inuit associations. That doesn't mean they're all putting money in, but it means all of them will entertain an application from me and from the Youth Council pretty much at any time. So we've done some really interesting projects, and because I only have 3 minutes, I won't go into all of them, but we were talking about engaging young men earlier, so I wanted to mention that we have done a fairly ambitious small engine repair program that will be operating again this winter. We've done a land-based carpentry skills program where people have been building various structures on the land for the community, and that's being done by youth. The youth center was recently renovated at a cost of about $150,000, and all of the work was done by youth. So those are programs where most of the applicants have been men, although not entirely. Just now, to give you a couple of really current examples, we're in the middle of, I guess, an ongoing crisis in Penutung with youth suicide, which was sort of alluded to earlier. And I have funding from Health Canada that's allowing us to put a youth mental health outreach worker at the youth center itself. We're doing a new peer education, peer helper program in the schools, a series of coping workshops. With funding from GN Education, we're doing quite a number of cultural programs with elders in the schools and with students in a program called School Without Walls. We're also doing a night school, 4 nights a week, for people who aren't regularly going to school so that they can continue to upgrade their education. And finally, I guess some of the things that we have in the works, which I think are kind of interesting too, we have an application in front of the QIA right now for a youth mentorship program. It's kind of a big brother, big sister thing. We have a huge application with the National Crime Prevention Center that is supposed to be this close to the minister's desk, but they say that a lot. We have an application for youth victims of crime with the Victims Assistance Fund, and an application for a youth entrepreneurial center with CanNOR actually right now as well. So there are quite a few things in the works as the program continues. We face a lot of challenges. I made a little list, but I think we'll be coming back to discuss some of those challenges later on as a group. So I won't go into all of them. They can come up naturally, but I wanted to say they sort of fall into two general areas. One are the actual life challenges that youth face, which are very, very significant. And when we talk about funding challenges, that's one thing. But when we talk about substance abuse or youth suicide, or the fact that a lot of the mental health providers are not renewed, challenges like crime, childhood trauma, those sort of challenges, even funding, you know, isn't necessarily going to wipe those away quickly, for sure. But we do have a number of funding issues too, and some of them have already come up. Fiscal year-end problems and slow delivery of money and various other things that maybe we'll get into when we talk amongst ourselves on the panel. So that's quite enough from me.
Hallo, Emily Amladim Bjumer, Erlem Bjumjah Mildaujunga, Ubernayak Termut Imidrami Daneri Kut Ilaka Daujunga. I'm Emily Amladim from Cambridge Bay, and I'm involved with the Kitakmiut Heritage Society, which was established in 1996. Thank you, Kim. And yes, we started up as a simple project where oral history was, you know, part of our interest to conduct and to promote oral history. So we have a website, it's www.kitakmiutheritagesociety.ca. The KHS puts 500,000 to a million a year into the Nunavut economy. Most of this money comes from sources outside of the territory. We currently have 4 full staff, and we also have 5 elders on staff during the school year. We employ anywhere from 4 to 10 part-time students a year. We also work with and host researchers from around the world. In fact, the last 10 years, we have worked on one of the first research projects that combines traditional knowledge and archaeology. This work is being done in partnership with Dr. Max Friesen from the University of Toronto. And in 2002, we had built an innovative center that combines a cultural center, museum, archives, school and public library, art gallery, and a campsite. So that is what the Kitakmiut Heritage Society has been involved with. And the Kitakmiut Heritage Society Board of Directors is involved, mainly, like most of the elders, so the elders that are from the community gather together to conduct and to, you know, to conduct oral history. So we have done quite a bit of promotion of the Inuit language or the culture and the oral history. And some of our issues here, again, like we rely on project funding. Most of it is 1 year funding. Last year we had to write 45 proposals in, and this really impacts our ability to actually do the work that needs to be done. We have to compete with the government and other organizations for skilled staff. It's hard for us to compete with organizations who have high salaries and benefits. We have a very hard time getting financial support from our municipal government. We are very successful with our proposal, so there is an assumption that we are well-resourced. They don't understand how hard we have to struggle to stay alive in terms of, you know, keeping our culture and our, you know, promoting our culture and language. Thank you.
It's the world's most pervasive human rights violation. It's the violation most often ignored. Every minute of every day, women and girls are assaulted, threatened, raped, mutilated, or killed. That's a huge statement, and it's followed by a man who works in as a men's violence prevention educator who says, if there's no peace in the home, there's no peace on the streets. If there's no peace in the home, there's no peace in our communities. If there's no peace in the home, there sure isn't going to be any peace in Nunavut. I would like to, because I've talked many times today, I'd like to just ask you to remember those things and not go into them now. My time is limited. However, I'd like to say to you that the tremendous pressure that women are on, and are facing, rather, is to stay and to put up with this. You know, communities that are close communities can either help individuals and protect individuals, or they can trap individuals and intimidate individuals to put up with it. And often our women, you know, are facing this kind of thing. Less than 10% access shelters. And yet our shelter, which is a 21-bed shelter, functions between 30 and 40. And the phone is always ringing off the hook. There's a myth that if she makes it out of her community finally and into a shelter, that there'll be a Hollywood ending. Yet we find that everything she's been through and everything those kids have seen and been through come into the shelter. And we see the results of trauma on young lives. We see that brain rewired by so that these kids don't act like other kids. We've seen the difficulty they have in school, staying on task, respecting authority, when they've watched an abuser systematically take away power from someone else. Their relationships with their mothers have absolutely crumbled, and they have no respect for her. They have no respect for boundaries. They have no respect for concentration, for learning, for knowing what normal is in relationships, and certainly what normal is when you're dealing with other people and how you solve problems. The long-term effects of what we don't seem to pay any attention to are such that we have generations now of people growing up perpetuating that cycle. And they too solve their problems by pushing around a child or a partner. We can connect up this loss of productive person power in our economy, social and economic. We can directly link up her often having to flee a community, so she has to lose her job, lose her home, lose her possessions, lose her support system. The kids lose their school, their grandma, their friends. They go from a small hunting-based community to a large city like Iqaluit, where they will automatically fail in the schools. We see time and energy put into trying to work with her and her kids, but the systemic barriers that she will face. She can't get a house because you have to live here for a year before you can hand in the application, and then they'll tell you to wait 4 years. So she's got to wait 5 years, or she goes back to her three-bedroom house. Shelters with one room per family were never meant to live in long. People lose their skills as they live in shelters when someone else is doing the cooking or the cleaning or owns the building. People lose their chance at training or any kind of job ladder climbing, because they've had to flee so many times to Iqaluit or to other communities. The relationships are disrupted in the friendships for these kids, never mind the academic challenges. The secrets that the family has carried and the dysfunctional way they've lived with a white elephant in the room called violence means they have no idea what normal is, and therefore they don't know how to begin to solve their own problems post-shelter. the enormous liability this presents to Nunavut, to have half of its group down on their face, as we talked about earlier, the lost voice, and the other half with their eyes swollen so shut they can't see to get up the stairs in the shelter, or 47 bite marks on their body, or a shovel taken to their genitals, all while the children watched. This is certainly both an aberration of human life and human rights, but it is directly impacting on the progress we can make in terms of economic development, in terms of productivity, in terms of training attendance, in terms of a continuing education, in terms of people who are ready or not ready and fit to learn. For us to think it just affects one woman or one family or one abuser is illogical. It is affecting everything that I can possibly think of that does not permit us moving forward and having any kind of real significant growth at the human level, the economic development level, the education level, the political level. It robs us of all of them. Certainly, if she makes it to a shelter in the one room, there's nothing in the place for the spectrum for her to move on. So they are landing like cordwood stacked in shelters, far less than what the family had when they fled. And therefore, the temptation to go back and take more of it might get you two extra bedrooms. Is that the price? The fact that almost all departments have no plan at the federal or territorial or local levels to deal with the needs of someone who has to flee shelter elsewhere in a supposedly zero tolerance for violence environment, where there are not one program, one agency, or one policy that will support her and her very, very damaged children. As part of the social economy and as part of the private sector, public sector economy, I don't know how we're allowing this to continue. As the biggest holdback, he's not in good shape, she's not in good shape, they're not in good shape. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Norman Ford. I'm from the County Clinic of HTO. I've been with the HTO for working on my fourth year, and this is my first time at a summit like this, and it's very, lots of information that came out this morning. And I know the 2 years that were put out were very interesting for me. From my hometown, it was 64, 67, the cooperative movement and the HTOs. That's when the movement started for our HTO, but also at the same time, the Kisapik Co-op is very vital, very important to us at the community level. I was very mesmerized, more or less, but there's a lot of information that I can take back and start using, because there's lots of points here that are we've gone through social economy, and I know in our field in the HTO we're trying to develop the country food program or country food sales and trades with other communities, and that has been one of my struggles for the last couple of years. We're trying to get the freezer fixed up, and that's what I saw here was a lot of struggles between governments and between private sector, and then on the same time we're non-profit and we want to go into profit, so I was being on the state side or part of the state, so we can step out there, we can take a step into the economy side and make money. And I know we've been holding back our profit-oriented type plans where we could easily start making money with more sales of country products, but at the same time the tax tax man is right there. You can't make more than $30,000 and you start making payments for taxes. So we're very aware of the tax. And we've been working with NIWS, who's very helpful with us. The NIWS is a new body that was put to help all the HCOs, because we're all under one umbrella now with NIWS, where all the HCOs are represented in this NIWS, where they take care of the funds. We report all our funding to them, go through them, and that's taken a lot of load from the HCOs. We'd be doing a lot of our time doing the taxes, but now they're doing it for us. So we've got lots of time to deal with all the research projects that are out there. We have to deal with all the different mining companies that want to do mining. And at the same time, we have a lot of our wildlife issues that have to be looked at. And, you know, there's a lot of wildlife that we have to try and make sure there's no interruptions or their migration routes or their hibernation areas, that we try and keep control. There's no interruptions when the animals are, you know, developing their habitats. And we've seen more and more helicopters flying around now in Rankin, and we have been concerned. I've seen a lot of emails going on with our peregrine falcons, that emails being a lot of that going on the peregrine falcon itself. And all the wildlife are very affected. Once one species is affected, all the other species get affected too. And we've seen the bird migratory area in our area of town. We used to have a lot of little sandpipers, and those have disappeared. I mean, not really totally, but there's a lot less, and there's a lot of birds like Pichulop and Arctic terns. Those two species have moved up. As the warmer climate is being coming up, we've seen a lot of migrations going up further north. Even the grizzlies, they're making their way up. So we have a lot of concerns with wildlife, and we've been very fortunate to have that new body, NIWS and KWB and all these, and NWMB, and we get caught in between, like our land base or our state, what you call NTI, being there for us, giving us some funding, and government giving us some funding, and we get sort of tied in between the two of them, and there's struggles. Like at one point, GM used to be like give us funding for $1,000 a month for gas. I mean, that was the basic funding that was given to the HCOs, and right now we're, you know, that's $12,000 a year that they used to get back in the startup of the HCOs. But now their our operating budget's around $100,000, $120,000. That's like one employee for NTI or government, some of the higher staff. And, you know, there's a cartoon that looks at this meat walking, like we see the one guy getting earnings of $120,000, and we're running on $120,000 budget. And not only me, but all their social economy, they're all in the same struggles. And I just seen that today. And we're very grateful that the HCO has gone this far with a lot of help. Both sides, NTI and government, are. That's the big thing, unity. If there's unity, we'll have support, we'll have equality to in support of each other, we can seek those funds better. And in closing, I'm almost done. I'd just like to, I came into the, with the doc teams at the time. My dad had a doc team and I was there. I was real fortunate to be one of the guys that did catch the doc team area. I remember going on doc team on a real sunny day, and my brother was in front, my dad in the middle, I was in the back, and 8, 9, 10 dog teams in front of us, and it was a real experience for me to be on that sled with a sunny day and traveling, doing my dad's round for trap line, and it's always like being a very touching moment for me when I look back at it. Because when I went to school, I grew up with my native tongue, my mother's tongue, and I had a hard time going up through school, but the time that the dog leader was, like, it's always important to have a good dog team, have a good leader, and it's the same way. With our projects and everything, that we got to be there, even though when I was filling out the questionnaire, there's like lots of questions, and we do the books, we do the translation, we do the about 3-4 positions job we're doing at the HCO level, and a lot of that I've been contributing to, like, part of it for volunteer work. So that questionnaire was really tough in figuring it out, but it's very, very useful now that knowing all these things are going on, and that we can get unified and get more help. Anyway.
Thank you. My name is Jocelyn Boutier. I'm the accountant at the Polaroo-Cadoux Friendship Center in Rankin Inlet. The Friendship Center movement is very active all over Canada, mostly southern Canada. The main goal is to help urban Aboriginal people. There's a difference with ours a little bit because, first of all, we're the only Friendship Center in Nunavut, and also we're pretty much the only one that dealing mostly with Inuit people. So it's a little bit different. We're going to celebrate our 13th anniversary this year. It's a long time. Of course, it grew mostly, I would say, in the last 10 years, because it started very small. Now we deal with a vast variety of programs. You know, we run a preschool in one of the schools. We run the Canadian prenatal nutrition program for dealing with pregnant women or women with very small babies. They learn sewing, cooking, that kind of stuff. We also run the school bus service for the preschools in the community of Rankin Inlet. We also run a library with a bunch of computers mostly for the young people. Everybody is invited to go, but mostly for young people. We have also a dental hygiene program in the school, a spousal abuse program, like we were talking about, for mostly for the victims, but also according to court order, we do counseling also to abuser when the case happened. And we have a more general program for victim assistance. For people who have to deal with the court, who were victimized in a crime, we help them by counseling and also in the court if they have to be witness, for example. Other program is the youth program. We call it youth program, but it's really a program to relate young people with elders so they can transmit their knowledge, their traditional knowledge. So mostly they go on the land, but it could happen also inside for some carving or things like that. The biggest program for the last 3 years has been what's called Kivalik Outreach Program. It deals with the residential school victims. That's the best funded program from the federal government. That's the only program that we expand out of the hamlet of Rankin Inlet. We have one full-time employee in Repulse Bay, the same in Coral, in Arviat, and in Chesterfield Inlet. So we were talking this morning about the lack sometimes of volunteers. There's a yes and there's a no on that, you know. We have a 9 volunteer board of director. It's sometimes difficult to fill the 9 position on a long-term basis. People are optimistic when they start after the AGM, but after a couple of meetings, sometimes they don't come back. But then again, some of them are very reliable. We have a board member that's been there for 30 years. Mrs. Anna Benoit. We were giving her an award this year, and she's been volunteer member for 30 years. So it's pretty impressive. So that's pretty much what we do. We were talking of the importance of social economy. In our case, if you don't count the government and or organization like NTI, I would think that we're the biggest employer in Rankin Inlet. We have now more than 30 full-time employees and a bunch of casual or honorarium employees. So I think we do a good job. We seem to be appreciated by the population, and we try to go on. The only problem is that most of our programs are 1 year, 2 years, maximum generally 3 years. So we are always waiting for the decision of the government. Are you going to renew the program? Is there going to be any change? And sometimes we get we know it at the last minute pretty much. Like the Kivalik Outreach Program, for example, we still don't know if it's going to be renewed on 31st of March coming. So a lot of employees depend on it, and we try to know, and we try to push the ID, but we're at the mercy of the government in a way, but we're very grateful to them too, because most of our funding is coming from the federal government and the government of Nunavut. So we hope for the best, and up to now it seemed to go in the right direction. We've been upgrading our program for the last 10 years, especially the last 5 years. Thank you.
Thank you, panel. And we want to open up for questions. We've got a wireless mic here, so if you wouldn't mind raising your hand, we can come to you. And happy to answer questions to the panel. Okay.
Maybe probably just talk about.
Okay.
For, I can't remember your name.
Oh, Caroline?
Sorry.
Thank you. It's something I left out. In a recent disclosure, it said that 1% of Nunavut have 63% of the money in Nunavut. And Norman's comment is well taken, and certainly yours and everyone else's, your struggles. Because indeed, all of the things I described, we ask people to come in and make $17 an hour to work in that kind of trauma. And yet, if we directly looked at the job descriptions of these folks, it would rival that of approximately 2 social workers. And each social worker, when you work out all the real true costs of before their rear end can sit in the chair, comes to $225,000. Our people, all local, all highly invested, make $17 an hour. You could make more at the storehouse bar or flipping hamburgers. So I think it's a very, very excellent question. And how do we rationalize paying so low when, in fact, these frontline agencies that are the social economy can always deliver things better, closer to the ground, faster, and will do so much more, but almost to their own deficit, because they're worked to death carrying out things while a very highly paid civil servant is sitting there wondering whether to give it to us. And so there is such a disconnect there about you say, for instance, zero tolerance, or you want hunter and trappers organizations, or heritage protection, promotion and preservation are where it's at. But none of the dollars seem to have that trickle-down effect to those that will carry these things out and will be in those front lines day after day after day. So we have to look at the limiting factors in the social economy. Why does 1% have 63% of the resources and a very good life?
Can I comment on that too?
Just a couple of related issues to that too. Some of the funding we have comes from places like Akavak or other government programs that set a certain amount that they'll contribute. Federal government programs often contribute 50% of the minimum wage, which is $5 an hour. It's almost not worth getting the grant, because the casual wage for someone who shovels the snow off the steps of the hamlet in our community anyway is $14.79 an hour. So getting $5 from the federal government, you've got a long way to go. And Kakavak, I think, is $14 now. This isn't great either, really. The other problem we have is that, as you said, a lot of the programs are a limited amount of time. So even if you can pay a fairly good salary, the person has no guarantee the job's going to continue past that. And meanwhile, we're a decentralized community, so we have a number of GM departments there just across the river. And they're sniping people all the time, and they can offer longer terms and better money. So for the social economy organizations here, I imagine that's a problem we all face.
You're saying the $5 an hour is not worth pursuing because?
Well, because first we can't pay anybody that, so we've got to raise the rest. But we wouldn't, I don't think, summer student jobs, just an example, $5 an hour. I don't think I could get a summer student for $10 an hour in Pangatuck. I don't know. I'm looking at Kara, who's here as well, but I think we have to pay ours with the hamlet at least 15. So I've got to raise the other 10, right? So it's in that respect that it may not be worth getting the $5 if I can't raise the other 10.
Plus the paperwork says.
Plus the paperwork, absolutely. Plus the paperwork, right. Dealing with the bureaucrat on the other end, who at the end of the summer says, how come your students didn't work all their hours? You know, they could have worked 690 hours, and you've only got them down planning 540. And I say, well, they wanted to go hunting with their father that week. Was I supposed to say no? I mean, if I'd said no, I would have resigned anyway. But is that understanding, you know, the cultural norms in summertime, the seasonality of it, explaining that to the bureaucrats, following paperwork, you're right, those are aspects as well.
Another aspect is so many of our groups are on such short-term funding. Our government departments who come up with things, you know, do it on a 12-month or 5-year plan or whatever, but we're expected to deliver, you know, in terms of being part of the social economy. And we don't know, as you said, quite correctly, if you'll even be around to do that. If anybody will tell you if you've got the money. If anybody will help you get the money. The lack of multi-year funding, a government would never put up with that. A private sector source would never put up with that. Yet we're being asked to do something and to work with no certainty, no support, no security at all. When I look at Clyde River's Ilisasavik, one of the most creative projects I've ever seen in terms of the social economy, I think those folks there, you know, created something like 40 or 50 jobs in that community. And yet they had to write 67 different proposals, and it literally burned out the people they had who were employing everybody and getting that community well and on the right path. They burned out. There was never enough, and it was always constantly another reporting date for shekels, for crumbs. So how is it that we insist on treating this sector so poorly when it's the only one that will be able to deliver in a way that no one else can?
Chris?
Yeah, I don't think I need the microphone. I'll just ask a general question. Well, two-part question. You as a social economy organization, do you have things that you would like people to research, and what are those things if there are?
What I find is even with the cultural aspect of like in Nunavut, we want to promote. That's it's natural for us to, because we're in Nunavut, and culture and the language will never go away. And it's like we need to see sometimes, so, like working with the cultural center, sometimes I feel like, you know, or working alongside with the elders, are we social workers or not? We're here just to promote the culture. And sometimes it feels like, you know, because so many people are wanting to understand their identity as an Inuit or Inuit, and that how do we go about, you know, how can we help each other too? Because it is, you know, the culture and the language will always be there. And, you know, we need to see that it's important that as Inuit, we've helped for thousands of years, you know, that's always been our part. Now we need to use that and work together to, you know, to enrich and to help our Inuit.
Yeah, you asked about what can you do for research, and my answer would be to check to see if all Nunavut Mute and Labrador Mute and Western Arctic can be united in a way, like they're pretty soon going to be using the waterways for ships and icebergs going through the Northwest Passage, and I think the North has to be unified. And you know, our wildlife has been a very big symbol for, it's our way of life to have traditional foods, and the ships going through or the oil tankers going through, we have to be unified and say, look, this North belongs to the North. It's like Russians have put a flag under the bottom of the sea and Americans claiming the North Pole, but we've been living here all these years. We've been living here, and it's our way of life and our food that's being affected. And I just like to find a way to unify all the North to try and say it's we're here. It's our home, and that we're Canadians. And we don't have to go to America, we don't have to go to Russia and say, let's make a deal, we'll let you go through, or something like that. But we're Canadians already, and we just want to be unified and find a way to try and make something happen for the North to be unified to prevent the disturbance of our waterways. Thank you.
In answer to your question, there's a lot of research that can be done. Collecting statistics that our current governments don't collect. You know, why is it at the, you know, we found it at the Inuit Circumpolar Health Conference in July that 1/3 of all pregnant women in Nunavut are malnourished. Why is it we had to wait for every 4 years for this group to have a meeting so we could find that out? Why is it that we had to learn that that a great majority of the population are anemic? Why did we have to wait so long to realize that we're human chimneys up here and seem proud to be smoking at 72%, and when the south is down to between 18% and 21%? We haven't had the campaigns, the health promotion. We're not even given the stats. Our government wouldn't even tell us which communities had H1N1. It's a big secret. So, you know, we really need stats to fight for things. And if we don't have these statistics and quality research, how can we fight for these things? We should all be outraged today from anything we've heard. Why aren't we? Why does it take so long for you to know if you can help the next person April 1st? You know, why is it that, you know, each of the problems that are and challenges we're facing, it seems all by ourselves? You know, are we the canary in the mines? We should all be noticing we are the canaries and have the stats and the research, very good social action research that moves us forward and gets these kinds of dialogues at every meeting? How many meetings are you used to sitting at where none of these subjects are ever raised?
Sometimes when I hear that another researcher is in town, I'm tempted to say not again. But however, it was interesting to see some of the things you guys are researching that could be quite valuable for those of us who are writing grant applications and such to have that information. So I feel a little bit better disposed towards you after this meeting. But I did want to say, well, maybe it's just because I work for Hamlet, but I would be interested in knowing more about if research has been done on the role of municipal government in the social economy, both as a player in the social economy, but also as a supporter or not supporter of it. I don't know, you know, my colleagues all live in different communities. In our community, the municipal government is certainly helpful to the social economy. The finance department does the books, for instance, for a number of nonprofit societies. They do charge an admin fee, but only if it comes out of a grant that the group is already getting that includes an admin fee. They will find a vehicle for me if I need to get youth to somewhere, you know. Could they do more? I think they could, frankly. But the role of municipal government in the social economy would be one area that would be interesting to know how the other communities work. I'll bet that the Friendship Society probably gets a lot of support from their Hamlet. Or maybe not. Anyway, that's an area I'd be interested in.
Sometimes.
Okay, so, you got one more, Justin?
Yes. Maybe one thing that would be useful is to have some kind of catalog of government program which would be easy, it would be easy to find something. I'll give you an example. We have what we used to call the Elders Van at the Friendship Center for 3-4 years at least. And it was very popular. It was free for the elders, and it was good for us. It was complimentary for the position of the bus driver, because the school bus driver, of course, they drive maybe 4 hours a day or something like that, so they could drive the van and have a full-time week. And we had a little bit of funding here and there, but there was no way, even though it seems to be a good cause, to find some real funding to fund the salary of the guys. And the board didn't want to remove that program, but we were, for 2 years, we ran a big deficit, and we had to say, you know, it's dangerous for the survival of the Friendship Center, and we had to close it up. But we talked to a number of federal, provincial, the Hamlet, even private business, they're ready to put, like the Northern Store was ready to put his name on the van, but it's $25,000 a year or something, or $20,000, you know, it won't run the van for more than a couple of months. So it's very hard to find, there's so many programs, so many sources of funding, but nothing that match what we need sometimes, you know.
In terms of research, recording and preservation traditional knowledge or histories and placemates, develop Inuktitut and English educational resources and assisting researchers in the community and outside of the Nunavut. So that's part of what the Hedelmut Heritage Society would be, assisting with the heritage alongside and collaborating with the elders, like, you know, with our researchers, you know, we would ask the elders, like, what, you know, will this be relevant to our community? Yes, it will. It will educate our youth. It will, you know, it will be there for our community.
So, thank you, panel. So, let's give a big round of applause.